kept him away from his thoughts. A creak. A scuff. The release of a breath.
Taryn?
That voice. That voice. Everything came back in a rush. How he'd been on the verge of defeat, floating in a sea of enemies. The voice he'd heard in his head. Her voice. The way he'd clung to it like a stone. How suddenly there were warriors around him, knights, their swords flashing, his enemies falling. And then her face, her beautiful face, and her tears falling like life-giving rain.
Anise,
he breathed, drawing her name out like a prayer.
I'm here.
And then she was, her hands clasped in his, which hurt slightly because of the cuts and bruises he bore, but he didn't care. He squeezed back harder. Her lips found his, and he leaned forward into them eagerly, drinking from the only well that could possibly sate his great thirst. Her hands cupped his chin, sliding along his smooth skin tenderly.
I love you,
she said into his mouth, and they were the sweetest words he'd ever heard, ever tasted on his tongue.
Move over.
He did, very slowly, very gingerly, and she squeezed onto the bed beside him. He turned into her, her hips pressing against him, her body folding into him like time and distance had never separated them, like they were always this close. He winced as she groped at his chest, pain flashing from one of a dozen wounds.
Sorry, she mumbled. Perhaps we should wait.
Wait? That word was the enemy now, and Taryn wouldn't be defeated by it.
No, he growled. We'll be careful. We'll go slow.
She nodded, her eyes burning in the shadowy darkness. Time melted into the night, and as their passion flowed like a river, 1 second could have been an eternity, a lifetime. In those stolen moments, Taryn lived many lifetimes with Anise, and those he hadn't faded into the darkness of the past. Sometime later, Anise nestled into his shoulder, one hand resting lightly on his chest. Groggy, satisfied sighs slipped from her lips.
I thought I might never see you again, she said, after a few brief moments of silence.
Taryn knew the feeling. Worse, it was he who had made her feel that way. There was nothing else to say but,
I'm sorry. Don't be sorry,
Anise said.
Just don't do it again. I won't.
It was more than a promise. It was a vow pledged on everything he'd ever cared about. He paused and then said,
Did you ever wish you could strip everything else away?
Taryn knew it was a cryptic thing to say, but Anise immediately laughed and said,
All the hell frozen time!
Really?
More than anything. Have you forgotten I was the princess who wanted to flee to the hinterlands?
He had. He could hardly imagine such a thing now. It felt as if Anise was always the queen.
So you wouldn't drift away if you could. Live a simple life.
Anise's lips brushed his chin, his neck, and for those brief moments he forgot what he'd asked. When Anise spoke, he struggled to concentrate.
There's no such thing as a simple life, she said. Life, by its very definition, is a complex creature. Anyone who believes otherwise is a fool.
Taryn laughed, which made him hurt. He groaned.
Then I count myself lucky, for I am as complicated as they come.
Can I ask you something? Anise asked.
Who was he to deny her a question? Even if she wasn't the queen, he would deny her nothing, not ever again. Of course.
Is it my imagination, or have you grown even larger? He laughed again, louder, which hurt even more. But he relished the pain, for it meant he was alive. Perhaps more alive than he'd ever been.
Possibly. It's hard to tell. Everyone just looks little to me these days.
Well, perhaps you could put in a request to that monster of yours to stop the growing.
Why?
Because if you get much bigger, this... She pulled him into her, grasped his hands, tugging them to her hips. Will become far too difficult.
Good point, he said.
But his words were lost against her lips.
One more question, she said, after they lay, exhausted once more.
He laughed. I should start charging.
I'll pay you in favours, she purred.
Ask away, he said, with boyish eagerness that belied the man's body he wore.
The monster, she started.
Something rumbled deep in his core, but he held it back with sheer force of will.
Is it gone? I don't feel its claws in me any more.
He hated to tell the truth, but he wouldn't lie to Anise. Not ever again. No, he said. It will never be gone.
Good.
He frowned, a difficult expression to form, considering her hands had begun to slide along his abdomen, exploring. Good? How is that good?
It's a part of you, she said. You wouldn't be the same without it. And it saved me, twice.
Out on the ice, and in the tunnels.
And in the midst of the battle, it saved you.
You cannot deny it. No, he couldn't. As much as he despised the violent creature inside him at times, he couldn't rebuff the connection he felt to it. Nor the fact that it had, in a way, strengthened his connection to Anise even more. Fooling him into believing she was dead was a nasty trick, but it only made him realize that he couldn't live without her, even if it meant endangering her with his very presence. All he replied, however, was, On the ice. In the tunnels.
Oh, do I have a story to tell you, she said.
And just wait until you hear about how the Ghazi almost shoved us off a cliff. Before he could respond, her lips whisked him away to another place, a place only the two of them could exist, for the third time in a night. And he didn't mind one bit. They had the rest of their lives to tell stories. 49. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth stood on the killing fields, her breaths coming in waves, her hands on her knees, her entire body racked with agony. She wasn't injured, no. The pain was theirs, the fallen. She could hear their souls crying out to her as they left their bodies, mournful wails that seemed to cut her to the quick.
I did this, she thought. I came to this place. I brought death. I am war.
Yes. The Queen had made the decision in the end, but to pass blame was to deny the truth of the matter, that she had a choice.
Why am I here? To kill?
To end lives?
To destroy cities? Why? Please tell me.
She didn't know who exactly the question was meant for. The universe, perhaps. But it was the knights who answered. The sleeping knights ceased their prowling through the corpses. They were seeking enemies who still lived to put them out of their misery, each turning toward her. Their soundless voices joined as one. You are the bringer, they said, thunder in those four words.
Bringer of what?
You already know, they said, turning away, going back to the business of death. She remembered that word she'd heard before, hoard.
Am I the one bringing the fall of all things? She wondered.
Lisbeth looked away, up toward the heavens from whence she came. Gold stars glittered. Green stars exploded. Red stars streaked across the cold, dark expanse of eternity. And she knew.
No, I am the bringer of hope. Whatever is coming, I am here to help. My work is not yet accomplished.
She closed her sightless eyes, but that provided no comfort, not when her third eye continued seeing, was always seeing. Just then a man ran up, his soul pearlescent blue and weary, his hands trembling. His soul was young, far too young for war, and yet she could smell the coppery tinge of bloodstains on his hands. He held a scroll of wet parchment, which had a green soul of its own, a remnant of the tree from which it was harvested, rolled up and dripping.
Where is the queen?
He asked Lisbeth.
Sleeping, she said. What is it?
He paused, as if trying to decide whether the news should be shared with anyone other than the Queen herself. In the end, he seemed eager to shift the weight of the information from his shoulders alone.
Castle Hill is under attack, he said.
Lisbeth froze.
By whom? The Eastern Legions. Had the Easterners attacked through the pass, using the siege of Darin as a distraction? And if so, why hadn't she discerned this truth from the stars?
No, Northerners, he said, and her heart sank.
They call themselves the Brotherhood.
Lisbeth said,
Thank you.
The boy turned away, and she suddenly felt very tired. Her legs gave way, and she would have fallen if not for the strong arms that caught her, lifting her up easily. A man with a familiar faded blue soul looked down at her. Sir Dietrich, one of Anise's companions on her quest into the hinterlands. The amusing, charming one. Or, at least, he tried to be.
Thank you, she said, suddenly breathless.
Are you unwell? He asked, his soul fluttering with concern. She shook her head.
Just tired.
Can you walk?
She didn't think so. I just need to rest for a while.
Nonsense. I will find you a bed.
No, she said. Please, take me to the Queen.
50. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Zelda Gehrig. Due to the invasion, Lady Zelda had missed breakfast. She hated missing meals. Then again, for the first time in her life, she had no appetite. She'd fought alongside her men, but it was a losing cause from the beginning. Though they had the numbers, the dark-cloaked attackers had the experience, the skill. It was a slaughter. Sir Christoph Metz and the other half of their army, the women, were, of course, nowhere to be found. The funny thing was, she'd expected him to go to Darin's aid. Though, as the temporary queen, she'd been unable to give him the order, she'd offered him plenty of latitude with her command. She'd even watched him leave with his women soldiers. Moments before the battle began, Zelda had sent a stream to Darin warning them of Castle Hill's fall. The Brotherhood had left no man alive. Zelda would rather they'd killed the women, too.
I wish they'd killed me,
she thought now, as the sellsword leader, Severon, approached her cell. He wore a fine suit of armour, likely stolen from a lord somewhere, the gleaming plate partially hidden beneath his dark cloak. He was flanked by two other cloaked men.
You killed one of my men, Severon said without greeting.
Two, actually, Zelda said. You just haven't found the second one yet. Follow the trail of blood. Shouldn't be too difficult, even for a yak brain like you.
He grunted, but not in anger. It was more a sound of amusement. He pushed several tendrils of stringy black hair away from his face, tucking them behind his ears. They immediately fell back across his sharp green eyes.
Your entire pathetic army was decimated by my 59 men and 57 men now, she reminded him.
A smirk.
Yes, 57. None of your men could kill a single one of us, but you managed to kill two. Your reputation doesn't do you justice.
The only reputation she was aware of was that she was a reclusive madwoman, but she didn't mention that. Instead, she said,
Let the women go. They have nothing to do with this.
It was a fruitless request to make of a soulless man such as him, but she had to try.
No. Who else will clean the blood from our clothes, prepare our food, pamper us like the lords we now are, like the king I have become?
Zelda laughed, loudly. He frowned, the scars on his face shifting, darkening.
Something amusing. Besides the smallness of your mind. Your arrogance, for one.
How so?
You're a sellsword, Severon. Nothing more, nothing less. You and your men are a fungus on this land. Small, sad men like my brothers have kept you in business, but your days are numbered. When Anise returns,
I'm trembling in my boots, Severon said. The real soldiers are all dead. I watched them perish until the waters of the Bay of Bounty ran red with their blood. The North died with them.
A child queen is the least of my worries, especially one who's run off on a fool's errand. So he knows.
Zelda had heard the screams as they tortured a few survivors for information. But it didn't matter. A man like him would never understand women like she and her niece.
and he would always underestimate them, which was exactly the sort of advantage they could use. Zelda knew she would be smart to say nothing more, but she couldn't help herself.
"Do you really think the other kingdoms will recognize your claim on the throne?" she scoffed. "They'll read your streams while counting their coin, and then come for you with their armies, and you will die the same way you lived, friendless and with nothing to call your own."
Severon, to his credit, didn't rise to her bait. Instead, he only smiled. "We shall see," he said, starting to leave. After a few steps, he turned back. Almost as an afterthought, he said,
"I'll let you watch as I slit Anise's throat, and then I'll slit yours."
51. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Sir Christoph Metz. The news had spread like wildfire, eventually reaching Christoph's door in the form of a hard knock, jarring him awake. He stood instantly alert, sensing something important had happened. When he pulled the door open, he was surprised to find Private Cheery there. The memory of their fleeting moment of closeness from the night before sprang to mind. He'd ruined it by pushing her away, by asking her to leave. He still didn't know why he did it, only that as she began to kiss his neck, he'd felt like the walls were closing in, trying to crush him. Now, embarrassment roiled through him for a second, until he saw the troubled look on her face.
"What is it? What has happened?"
"Castle Hill," she said.
"What about it?"
She shook her head.
"Tell me."
"It's fallen," she said.
"How?"
She told him. He thanked her, closed the door, and slumped into a chair. Holding his head in his arms, he rocked back and forth, murmuring under his breath,
"My fault, my fault, my fault, my fault, my fault."
52. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Lisbeth Lorne. They stood before her in perfect lines, their backs straight, their heads held high. Their souls were coiled with unspent violence. She did not fear the knights, though she'd seen them kill without mercy. If anything, she feared herself, for she was the one who had unleashed them on these lands. She was the one who might not be able to stop them.
"We may need you again," she said now,
on orders from Queen Anise.
"We know," the knights said in unison, their voices echoing in her head.
"You serve the Queen?"
she asked.
"Yes, for now," they said,
a qualification that sent a shiver of fear through her. "For as long as the Queen serves the North." Lisbeth thought it was a strange thing to say, but didn't comment. Now was not the time to anger their strongest ally.
"Good. At first light, we march for Castle Hill. Your mission is to defeat the invaders."
"It shall be done,"
they said, stamping their feet, 100 sets of boots thundering in unison.
"The Brotherhood shall die."
Not for the first or last time. Lisbeth wondered whether she was doing the right thing. She hadn't told Anise about her visions of the Horde. She didn't fully understand them herself. She would, eventually, but not until after Castle Hill was retaken. Briefly, she touched her soul mark, which pulsed faintly on her forehead. 53. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Taryn Shiri. Taryn wouldn't have planned his reunion with Anise to involve a major battle in which he almost died, plus an invasion of Castle Hill. But he wouldn't complain. No, he would take whatever he could get. Never again would he waste one single moment with this woman. And he would follow her to frozen hell and back if she asked. For now, what she required was comfort, companionship. His arm was around her, her head tucked against his broad chest. Her work for the day was done, her commands given. The injured would remain behind, to be cared for by those with healing experience. The rest would march on Castle Hill. Taryn knew the monster would heal him swiftly, as it always did, and that he would be ready to march beside his queen when the time came.
"Zelda is alive,"
Taryn said now, because it felt like the right thing to say. It felt true. Anise's head dipped back, and she looked up at him. He could see the worry in her eyes, and it broke his heart. He would take it all away if he could, if she would let him.
"How can you know that?" she asked.
"The same way I know I love you," he said.
She smiled and briefly kissed his cheek. She pulled away, and her sudden absence made him feel cold. He knew what she was doing, and he would endure an eternity of ice if it allowed her to be the woman she'd become, the strong queen. Standing before him, the worry was gone, chased away by that stubborn Garrick jaw and those fierce, beautiful Garrick eyes.
"I love you, Taryn, and I love my kingdom, my people. I will retake Castle Hill. I've done it before, and I'll do it again."
There was nothing else to say, but,
"I know you will."
She nodded and left, slipping out into the night. The queen would not find sleep on a night like this. 54. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Anise Garrick. It was immensely difficult leaving the warmth of Taryn for the chill of the frozen night. Difficult, but not impossible. By now, Anise knew impossible didn't apply to her. Not any more. Leaving Taryn tonight was necessary. She had responsibilities. She had duties. People who looked to her for leadership. People who were willing to die for her. She swept through Darin, checking on the injured, trading quips with the soldiers eating around campfires. She considered locating Lisbeth and the knights, but decided against it. Something about them made her uneasy. It was natural, she supposed, considering they were from another place and time, suddenly thrust back into a world they'd been away from for a long time. Instead, she found Archer, who was sitting with Sir Dietrich and Sir Jonius, watching red stars shoot across the sky. "Couldn't sleep?" Archer asked, raising an eyebrow. She shook her head.
"There are far more interesting things to do than sleep, anyway," Dietrich said. "I figured after you forgave that metalhead for running away, you'd be shacked up with him every chance—"
"Sir," Jonius interrupted sharply, "you are speaking of Her Highness."
"And my sister," Archer added. Dietrich said, "You're right. I apologize. But you should still consider my advice. Go back to Taryn and have fun."
Anise shook her head as the knight left, likely off to cause trouble elsewhere.
"How is the big tin can, anyway?" Arch asked. "I trust you're taking good care of him."
"Almost fully healed," Anise said. "He'll have scars, but his blood serves him well."
"Who would have thought there were advantages to being cursed?" Arch quipped.
Exasperated, Anise said,
"Perhaps I should have stayed with him. And he's not cursed. He's just himself."
She thought of the way the monster had tricked him into thinking she was dead. Had it been playing games with him? Was it evil? Something told her the ploy had, in the end, been to help him, to fill him with enough pain and anger to keep him alive until she could arrive.
"Thank you," she said.
"You're welcome,"
the monster answered.
"Do you see now?"
"Yes," she thought. "I think I do."
"Now, if you could just get that stubborn man to understand."
Anise laughed, and both Archer and Sir Jonius looked at her strangely.
"If only," she thought.
But sometimes a person had to discover a thing on their own in order to fully appreciate it. She'd come a long way, they all had, but they still had a long way to go. The next stop was Castle Hill.
"I'm coming, Auntie," she thought. "You saved me once. It's my turn to return the favor."
Another scarlet star arced overhead, soaring westward, in the direction of Castle Hill. 55. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Something had changed in Rhea ever since she'd foiled Darkspell's nefarious plans on the banks of the Spear.
Or was it earlier? This thing inside of me. No, not a thing. A child. My child.
She had looked into the eyes of her enemy, a prince of the East and his Orion companion, and had not found the vile monsters she'd expected to find. No. To her utmost surprise, she'd felt a kinship amongst those with a shared purpose. But what purpose? Peace? She laughed at the thought, as she brushed the tangles out of her golden hair. No, there could never be peace, not on this war-torn continent. But perhaps alliances could be forged. Word had reached her ears of a great battle in the north, in Darin. The streams were alive with the news. The North, despite all odds stacked against them, had emerged victorious. They weren't dead yet, and perhaps the offer of an alliance from Rhea's cousin, Anis Garrick, still stood. Better yet, with the Easterners licking their wounds, she could play both sides, forging a second alliance with Gareth Ironclad and Gwendolyn Storm. Yes, a Northern alliance! The thought suddenly excited her, as nothing had for weeks. All we need is a common enemy, she thought, placing her brush on the table. And, of course, they already had one. The Southron nations of Calip and Fanes, embroiled in a civil war that would make them an even easier target. She glided toward the open doors to the balcony, a cool breeze rushing over her. As she stared into the blustery night, she considered. She could paint it as a war of good versus evil, but she knew an ulterior motive slid like a shadow around the fringes of her mind. Ennis. Though she would never be able to love him the way he wanted her to, she still loved him like a father, a brother, a friend. He'd been nothing but good to her, even in her darkest hours, and she'd ruined everything between them. But if she could find him, show him she was finally listening to his advice, that she had changed, then perhaps... She slammed her doors against the cold, turned away, folded herself under the warm blankets atop her bed, closed her eyes. A common enemy, Fanes. The rutting Calypsians had already opened the Rothdam gates for them. All they had to do was march through. Yes, the slave masters would fall, and she would be the one to push them. A plan formed in her mind. Her people were gathered, eyes turned expectantly toward her. It was time. They have no idea what's coming. Her past speeches had been delivered within the castle walls, her citizens packed inside, shoulder to shoulder, sardines in a can. On the broad banks of the Bay of Bounty, however, there was room to spread out, and her people did just that. The furthest spectators were nearly three-quarters of the way up the gradual incline to the castle. She would have to shout to be heard by all ears. This was the exact spot where Rathos had taken her sister, B. It was poetic, in a way, regardless of the outcome. A chill running through her, Rhea took a deep breath. It was time. She turned to the side for effect, tightening the folds of her bulky purity dress against her belly. "I am big with child," she declared. Gasps, whispers. Angry voices, fists raised. She raised her hand, and despite their righteous anger, the crowd quieted. "I continue to wear this purity dress with honour," she said, "for I have never lain with a man. Well, not on a bed, anyway." She and Grey had been on the mossy ground within the walls of her family's cryptlands. More gasps, this time alongside confused expressions. "Your humble servant, your committed queen, has been chosen by Roth to bear this fatherless child. I was as shocked as any of you. I still am. I am but a lonely woman. Who am I to claim this responsibility? However, it is not we who choose our destinies, but Roth above. But please, the truth of my words must not be believed on faith alone. I will put my words to the test and let Roth decide." The people were curious now, leaning forward eagerly. A typical trial of crimes was conducted by the Furies, but purposely Rhea had left them far away from this morning's festivities. "No man nor woman shall decide my fate," she thought. "Only Roth and Roth alone." Her knees trembled in anticipation. Everything that had happened since the moment Grey had abandoned her in the cryptlands, leaving only his seed behind, seemed to lead to this single moment in her life. She locked her knees, steeled her nerves, and raised her hands. This time, Rhea didn't have to say a word, nor did she have to look. She heard the churning waters, felt the waves sloshing against the shore, saw the monster's great eye reflected in the horrified stares of the onlookers, most of whom gasped or screamed or backed away or did all three in short succession. Children cried. Men drew makeshift weapons. Women prayed to Roth to deliver them. Rathos had come. Still refusing to look back, Rhea raised her voice above the din. "With Roth as my witness, this child is mine, and mine alone. If I bear falsehood, let Roth's servant swoop upon me and break my bones, crush my heart, devour my soul, send me to the first heaven to burn." Silence fell across the crowd. Bubbling water lapped against Rhea's ankles, overflowing the rocky embankment. She closed her eyes. "Guilty," she thought. "I am guilty. By my own words, I have condemned myself." Screams poured from a thousand mouths, and her eyes shot open. A thick, slimy tentacle flew past, curling around her, squeezing her pregnant belly slightly as it lifted her into the sky. The ground fell away as she ascended, the wind in her mouth, her heart in her throat. Though the instinct to scream was there, she refused. "I will go quietly. I am not afraid." The great eye appeared before her, and as she looked into it, Rhea felt as if she was staring into the eternities, a fathomless pit with no beginning and no end. Her judge, her jury. Slowly, Rathos pulled her away from its stare and toward its beaked maw, which opened wide, a black void sucking her into it. "So this is it," she thought. "This is what B saw. This is what she felt. Her fate is mine." The beak crunched down, making a raucous cracking sound. And then she was spinning away, the tentacle uncurling, ratcheting her back toward the shore. It set her back on the ground with surprising tenderness, sliding away, leaving her slick with slime. Grimy and soiled, yes, but alive. Something felt different, and she reached up to touch her hair. It was shorter. Her long golden locks snipped away by the monster's beak. A warning from Roth, she knew. A recognition of her lies, but a willingness to ignore them if she did what was required of her. Though she felt heavy with the child growing inside her, energy rolled off her in waves. Purpose, too. She'd stared into Roth's eye and been deemed worthy, her sins forgiven. "I'm coming, Ennis," she thought. "Wherever you are, I shall find you." She watched as the monster sank back into the depths. Concentric, churning ripples widened as it descended. When she turned back to meet the stares of her people, no one blinked, no one breathed. Until she raised her hands. And then they cheered. Oh, yes, how they cheered. After all, who could argue with the mother of Roth's child?
56. The Western Kingdom, the Southron Gates. Ennis Loren. The journey had been long and tiresome, but at long last they'd reached the last place in the Four Kingdoms Ennis Loren ever thought he would see. The Southron Gates. The wall rose high and thick, an impenetrable barrier against an attack from the west. And yet, between the jutting mountains of solid stone was a wide gap. The steel hinges were still in place, but the doors were gone, melted down into shapeless lumps of steel, having cooled on the dusty ground. It was said that the Calypsians, led by Empress Fire Sands herself, had destroyed two of the four gates before being stopped by a large contingent of Phoenician soldiers, masters of the martial art of Fenru. The two Furia who had chaperoned him this far pointed to the gap in the wall.
"Go," one of them said. "If you try to flee anywhere but south, we will kill you."
Ennis was certain it was a bluff. Rhea would never have ordered his death, this he was certain of, but he didn't want to run. He was ready, and he had made his choice, perhaps the final one of his life. He dismounted, the cracked ground beneath his feet nothing like the green plush lands of the West he was so accustomed to. Step by step he walked forward, refusing to look back, to show his fear. No, he wouldn't give Rhea's vicious servants the satisfaction. The wall cast a long, angled shadow across him as he approached. He expected shouts from atop the wall, archers leveling arrows in his direction, swords raised. Instead, he got the one thing he hadn't expected. Nothing. Standing between the gates on that mound of melted and then cooled steel, all he saw was dust and sand and burned land.
"I have entered the first heaven," he thought. "I am being punished for my numerous failures. I receive nothing less than I deserve."
The moment he stepped into Fane's, he got everything he'd expected. Shouts from above, loud and fierce. Arrows protruded from holes in the wall, aimed his way. Boots slapped stone steps as narrow-eyed Phoenicians, garbed in flexible leather armor, charged toward him. Strapped to their wrists were long knives, leaving their hands free to perform acrobatic maneuvers, flips and cartwheels and gravity-defying aerial twists as they surrounded him. Attached to each boot were long knives, which Ennis was certain could slash open his throat with a single kick. With that thought, he knew it was time. He thought of young Rhea as a child, the mischievous gleam in her eyes, her quick to laughter, sense of humor. He remembered how, after being apart from her for several years in the army, how surprised he was to return to Night's End to find her a woman grown, flowered and beautiful. At first, his unexpected romantic feelings toward his cousin had felt wrong considering their age difference. But, little by little, over time, he'd become comfortable with them, like a stiff new pair of boots requiring breaking in. He thought of how she'd shattered his heart with her news of the child inside her.
"Yes," he thought, "I am tired of fighting, of losing. I am tired of it all. Kill me," he said.
To his surprise, the Phoenicians laughed. Anger coursed through him. They would not deny him this final wish.
"Kill me!"
he roared, lowering his head and charging toward one of them, his eyes never leaving the gleam of the knives strapped to each limb. The man didn't move until the last moment, leaping away and slamming an elbow across the back of Ennis's head. Stars burst across his vision as he tumbled headfirst into the dust, scraping his nose and cheek. Voices, dull and muted, as if spoken from underground, drifted to his ears.
"Foolish Westerners," one said, "always thinking we want to kill them. Far more valuable as slaves they are. A strong Western slave like this one will make a valuable gift to Emperor Falkenhoser."
"No,"
Ennis gritted his teeth, the stars fading, fought to his knees, trying to push to his feet. Someone lifted him up and he swayed as the world spun.
"Sleep, slave,"
the spinning Phoenician said. He slammed his head into Ennis's face and everything went black. 57. The Eastern Kingdom, Ironwood. Gareth Ironclad. Gareth was surprised when they entered the iron-sheathed trees of Ironwood to discover it still felt like home. For some reason he thought he'd feel like a stranger here now, an outsider. But no. If anything, it felt like he'd never left, a thrill running through him.
"You feel it too," Gwen said, glancing at him. "This is our home. Time and distance and the twisting pathways of life cannot change that."
He nodded, and for once didn't feel like joking. He felt more like crying than anything. But he didn't. The last thing he wanted was to be seen weeping as he returned. His brother would only use it against him, take it as another sign of his weakness. Having a heart is not weakness, he thought, remembering something Roan had once said to him. At the time, he'd laughed it away as over-emotional drivel, but now the statement seemed almost prophetic. He was aware of the eyes that watched them as they slowly rode along the broad forest corridors that led to the city. They were Orions mostly, Gwen's people, perched on airborne bridges and platforms, their bright eyes staring intently. He didn't look at them. Though the urge was there to spur his horse to a gallop, he fought it off. A returning king must always remain composed. "Is that what I am?" he wondered. a returning king. Dressed in the torn, ink-stained, dirty clothing of a pauper, he felt like a fraud. No, he thought, gritting his teeth. This is my birthright, regardless of what happened at Raider's Pass. As if sensing his inner turmoil, Gwen said, Steady, Your Highness. The throne will not be reclaimed in a day. Her words comforted him. For one, it was the first time she'd used his honorific without sounding amused. She believed he was the rightful king. That was something, wasn't it? Secondly, he wasn't alone. It was an unusual feeling for Gareth, one he wasn't used to. Even growing up, surrounded by his brothers and parents, he never felt like he was part of the family. His title, Shield, had hung over his head from the day he was born, even if he wasn't aware of it until he was slightly older. I am not alone any more, he thought. I have Gwen. I have Roan, wherever he is. The thought made him sit up straighter, and all his fears and doubts seemed to fall away. Just ahead, the beautiful iron structures of Faria rose like great angular sculptures built to be a part of the forest, rather than something separate. Each plate of metal gleamed as sunlight breached the forest canopy. Aye, this is where I belong. This is home. Though butterflies fluttered through his stomach, Gareth ignored them. Before, when he'd entered the city of his youth, he would have done so with princely bravado, trading quips with his citizens, purchasing a sausage and onion sandwich, chewing irreverently and laughing with his mouth open. Not this time. Now he rode straight-backed and silent, poised, nodding to those he passed, most of whom gawked at him openly. More than likely, he'd been the subject of many a rumour and juicy morsel of gossip over the last month. Let them stare, he thought. They know nothing of what I've been through. The city's main thoroughfare fell away behind them, and soon they reached the castle's enormous iron gates. Several large guards defended them. Notably missing was Bjorn Stonesledge, their iron-marked leader. Though the guards, as they were trained, tried to hide their surprise, most of them visibly flinched when they realized who he was. One of them stepped forward to address him, one finger twirling his long red moustache nervously.
Prince, we didn't expect... No one told us you were coming.
Need a king of the East announce his arrival? Gareth said.
Begging your pardon, but the king holds court on the throne at this very time.
Not any more, Gareth said. Step aside. The guard flinched again, but didn't refuse him. A gap opened as the guard shouted,
Make way for Prince Gareth Ironclad!
Without a creak or jangle of chains, the iron doors opened, melting away to either side, controlled by one of the Aurians, who channeled the ore. As usual, the outer castle circle was abuzz with activity. Archers trained using strawmen targets. Legionnaires conducted mock battles with dull-edged swords. Grooms brushed down black-and-white horses. Armour was polished. Gareth ignored it all, even when he heard the whispers, saw the fingers pointed his way as all activity ceased, like he'd entered the calm, silent eye of a storm. They rode in a curving path around the outer circle, entering another gate and reversing direction. More stairs, more whispers. After several more gates and direction changes, they reached the great iron stairs. Here, they dismounted. "Are you ready?" Gwen asked. "I am the king," Gareth said. "I was born ready." Gwen grinned. "I almost believe you." With Orion's speed, she took the stairs two at a time. It wouldn't do for a king to arrive at court without a caller preceding him. He took them more slowly, relishing how his muscles remembered these steps. He reached the top just as he heard his brother say, "Gwendolyn Storm? I'll be damned." Instead of responding, Gwen said, "You're sitting in the king's seat." To his credit, Gryon laughed. He stopped when he saw Gareth standing behind her.
"Brother, is it truly you? I wouldn't have thought you'd have had the nerve to crawl back to the country you failed."
Gareth stepped forward, refusing to rise to the bait. In his youth, he'd have charged his brother, settled this with fisticuffs and much scratching and clawing. But that boy was gone now, leaving behind the man he'd been forced to become. "Prince Grian," Gareth said, "you shall address me as your highness from this moment forward." His brother tried to hide his discomfort behind a smirk, but a twitch in his eye gave him away.
"Prince Gareth," he said, "you stepped down from the throne. You spoke the words. You did the honourable thing. Don't ruin it now."
"I was injured, Grian. There were a dozen witnesses, including Gwen. I was coerced into speaking the words against my will.
Liar!"
Gareth finally noticed something. The others in the room were all legionnaires, generals, advisers. This wasn't just any meeting. This was a council of war.
"What has happened?" Gareth said.
"It is not your concern," Grian said. But again, the quiver in his voice gave away his unease.
"Beyond Stonesledge wasn't at the gate," Gareth said. "The Ironmarked has many responsibilities."
Grian refused to meet his eyes as he said this. A man cleared his throat, looking equally uncomfortable. General Jorgundium, a man who'd been appointed to his position by Gareth's father almost a decade ago.
"Do you have something to say, General?" Gareth asked.
"Not a word," Grian said, firing daggers at the man.
"I cannot let this farce go on a moment longer," the man said. "Throw me in the stocks if you must."
He turned to Gareth.
"The Ironmarked is dead."
"What?"
Gareth and Gwen said at the same time.
"General!"
The warning was still in Grian's tone, but it had lost its sharpness. The general went on.
"It's true. He fell at Darin. We thought the city would be all but undefended, so only a small force was sent over the Black Cliffs. I was against it from the beginning, but I was overruled."
"Speak another word, General, and you'll be wishing for death,"
Grian roared, pushing to his feet. His face was beet red. The general ignored the outburst.
"Instead, the Northerners had two sets of reinforcements. We were decimated. Stonesledge fell."
Grian was livid.
"Arrest him, for insubordination and treachery of the highest order."
None moved. The general said,
"We are spread too thin. We wage wars on three sides, but they are ill-planned and overly hasty."
"We are winning in the south,"
Grian said, his jaw set.
"And the western forces have retreated back toward Night's End. What happened in the north was a minor setback."
It was Gwen's turn to speak. "The south? What progress have you made against Calypso? Have you crossed the Skara? Have you set foot on the Southron Peninsula?"
"Well, no," Grian said. "But we have defeated several bands of Calypsian savages on the edges of the desert. They were the Guarnero, their mightiest warriors."
"You fool." Even Gareth was shocked by the venom in her tone. Had it been directed at him, his legs would have turned to rubber.
"Excuse me," Grian said, not backing down. "You dare speak to your king that way? Just because my father gave you a long rope doesn't mean that I will."
"Your father was a wise man, a great warrior. You are but a child, next to the lifetimes I've lived. I knew another ironclad king like you, full of arrogance. He poked the Southron bear, too. Do you know what happened?" Stunned silence. "No? Well, I was there. It was my bonding day, in fact. Do you know your history, child? The dragon massacre was a day I will never forget."
"The dragons are dead,"
Grian countered, though his confidence was fading. He looked pale now.
"A sleeping dragon isn't the same as a dead one,"
Gwen said.
"They will return, and it will be because of you. Now step down with our thanks. You've done little but keep the throne warm for Gareth."
"I will not." Grian turned toward Gareth, an eerie calm entering his voice.
"You are a failed shield, brother. You have no place here. The people will never accept you as their king, and without the people you cannot rule."
In the past, his brother's words would have cut into him like 100 knives, but now they bounced off his skin. He was wearing a different kind of armor, the armor of truth and purpose.
"I may have failed as a shield,
but I am the shield no longer. He remembered Gwen's words, back amongst the decaying stumps of the rot. Now I am the sword. Gwendolyn Storm. The feeling started on her skin, a faint buzzing, almost like the precognition that comes before the arrival of a still distant storm. No. Her heart sped up, fleeting memories long buried rising to the surface. Fire. Claws. Death. Please, no. She'd spoken the words before as a warning, not a prophecy, and yet now she knew they were both. Gryon was screaming at his brother, at the generals, crying for arrests and trials, clinging to the throne like a fly to a leaf amidst a gale-force wind. She barely heard any of it, her keen ears trained skyward, listening. She heard the shouts first, then the bells, clanging their warning, their call to arms. Faria was under attack. That's when she heard a sound she hadn't heard in 8 decades. The beating of powerful wings. Part 2. Raven, Grey, Jai, Falcon, Bane, Roan, Bear, Windy. The half-marked are joined. A key is complete. A lock is opened. Their fates are sealed. The Western Oracle. 58. The Southern Empire, Calypso, circa 532. Raven Sands. What are our options? Raven asked her war council. For the moment, the civil war with Fanes had been put on hold. The more immediate threat came from the east.
Father, are you truly dead? She wondered.
Thus far, they'd only heard rumors of his passing. Until it was confirmed, Raven refused to let herself feel anything. As heads bobbed and turned to look at each other, Raven felt an eerie sense of déjà vu. Like her sister Fire, her first act as Empress was the consideration of war. These are dark times we live in, she thought. I'll speak, if no one else will, Ryder said. The dark-eyed Dragonmaster had long been a friend and ally to Raven. Though Ryder was at least 20 years older and had been training the Dragonia for years, she had a timeless complexion, her dark-skinned face unweathered by wind or sand, stress or battle. She wore a black cloak that typically flapped in the wind as she rode the dragons, but which now hung lifelessly behind her back. Thank you, Raven said. What do you propose? The Dragonmaster stepped forward, past the rest of the council. There were 5 others invited to the meeting. Goggin, the commander of the Guanero, the legion of elite warriors who rode their reptilian steeds, the Guanic, into battle. Ponjut, a brute of a woman and Goggin's second in command. She would go along with whatever he said. Shanalin, a narrow-eyed dragonmaster with 30 years of experience. Whisper, Raven's sister and the third daughter, who was heir to the Calypsian throne in the event Raven perished. And, of course, Ryder, who spoke now. My position has not changed. The Dragonia are almost a year from maturity, and their development cannot be forced. These attacks by the Easterners are not a major threat to the Empire. We should wait. Do nothing. Raven gritted her teeth, but not because she disagreed. She'd made almost the exact same argument in Fire's War Council, in regards to the civil war with Fanes. Was this really any different? Yes. The ironclad monarchy, which was now ruled by Gryon Ironclad, was attacking the nomadic border villages along the edge of the Skara Desert, but they were still hundreds of leagues from the southern peninsula. If anything, King Ironclad seemed to be goading Raven into taking drastic action where none was needed. Raven shifted in her uncomfortable throne. The dragon throne was intentionally full of spikes and hard edges, so that the ruler never got too comfortable in it. As her martyr had always said, ruling is a privilege, not a right. Goggin, Raven said, any thoughts? She was surprised she had to ask at all. The man was usually the most outspoken of her leaders. We can't do nothing, he said. One hand played with the mangled stub of ear he'd recently acquired in battle. He was fortunate the Phoenician arrow had only taken his ear and not his life. That is no option. The people will see you as weak.
They may rebel. Send a portion of the Guanero. We will clean up this mess with the East.
Goggin would ask to be sent into battle against a gang of bloodthirsty rabbits if he had the chance. He thrived on battle.
Raven sighed. You lost half your forces at the Southron gates. Your new recruits have never seen battle and are not fully trained. You would have me send them to the border.
Goggin pounded his broad chest.
We do not fear death. We serve the Empire with our strength and our blood, if necessary. All members of the Guanero have taken their oaths, and they will do as I command.
I am not questioning their honor, only whether we should spend more lives.
What other option is there?
Shanalin asked, though he didn't make it sound like a question. He paused, licking his dark lips.
Goggin spoke truly when he said we cannot do nothing. The Sands have always been strong. Calypso has always been strong. To do nothing would expose you to threats both inside and outside the Empire.
To Raven's ears, it almost sounded like a threat, though it was probably true. She nodded toward Ryder.
What say you?
I agree with that,
Ryder said slowly.
I doubt you'll agree with the rest of my proposal, however,
Shanalin continued, giving his fellow Dragon Master a pointed look. Raven knew from experience that the two most experienced Dragon Masters rarely saw eye to eye on such matters.
We should conduct the testing of the Dragonia early.
Absolutely not, Ryder said, shooting a glare at Shanalin. She turned back to Raven.
Empress, it has only been 3 months since they were last tested, and only one of the dragons came anywhere close to passing.
Raven already knew this. She had been there. In fact, she was the only one of her sisters who had bothered to attend. Heyron, the largest of the brood, had put on a spectacle, passing all but one of the tests and making the rest of the Dragonia look utterly inadequate.
I've been spending extra hours with the weakest dragons,
Shanalin offered.
They might surprise you. Anyway, what's the harm in testing them again? If they don't pass, it will make this decision much simpler.
Empress, if I may...
Ryder started to say, but Raven raised her hand to cut her off.
Shanalin's right, Ryder. It won't hurt anything. It will waste time that would be better spent training them.
True, but only a half a day, perhaps a day at the most. In any case, I would prefer to know exactly where their abilities stand.
As you wish, Ryder said.
Raven could tell from her tone that she was offended by the decision, but too loyal to speak out further.
What about the Guanero?
Goggin said.
While you're playing with your dragons, we could still send a small force to the border. Let us be your fist against the East.
Raven glanced at her sister, but Whisper seemed not to be listening, staring at her feet and playing with a lock of her flawless chestnut hair, which was so long now it kissed her hips. Her long silk dress was dark, as it had been for days, and lacked any of the usual adornments she adored. Raven wanted so badly to reassure her that she wouldn't die like their mother had, like Fire had, but she couldn't. Not now. As Raven considered, her hand absently moved to play with her long black hair, a habit of hers, but found nothing but empty air. She was still getting used to her short hair, which was in the awkward stage of regrowth after it had been burned off in the arena while she fought Fire for the Dragon Throne.
"Send 30 Guanero," Raven said, dropping her hand.
"I will lead them myself," Goggin said.
"No, Ponjut shall lead them. I need you here."
Goggin nodded, though there was disappointment in his expression. He would sorely miss another stop in Kesh, the oasis in the desert, renowned for its hospitality and spirit. Raven, however, would not miss Kesh. The last and only time she'd ever visited the desert village, Fire had almost been murdered in her sleep.
In the end, Fire died anyway, she reminded herself.
Thank you. That is all, Raven said. Everyone filed out, save for Whisper, who continued playing with her hair, oblivious to anything but her own thoughts. Raven watched her for a moment and then cleared her throat. Nothing. Her sister's huge brown eyes were glazed over, staring at something only she could see.
Whisper, Raven said.
Hmm?
She turned her head in Raven's general direction, but didn't make eye contact.